Thursday, June 26th. This is Studio 2 at WHYY. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman Arendt. Cherry, you know, I am loath to even acknowledge the city 90 miles to the north of us.
Yes.
I make a list of things I hate in this world. I got New York Mets, New York Giants, and New York Knicks right there at the top of the list. However, something big happened in New York.
Huge.
People are talking about it. One of the more surprising political results in recent memory. 33-year-old assemblyman. A guy no one really even had heard of.
Nope.
Zoran Mamdani knocks off Andrew Cuomo and, by the way, everyone else running for the Democratic primary.
By a considerable margin, too.
Yep. For New York City mayor. So we want to know what this means. We're going to talk about it today with a couple of folks who've got hot takes. We want to hear yours. I really think this is a good caller show.
This is the perfect caller show.
So let me cue you up with the question. Do you think the progressive victory in New York City is a lesson to the Democratic Party? Could Philly elect someone like Zoran Mamdani? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. If you're on YouTube, drop your comment in the chat. And if you also hate the New York Knicks, let me know.
Yeah, and you know what? I love our callers because they have that, they have hot takes too. And I know Philly is very...
Or cool takes. I like cool takes.
Or cool takes, yeah. Cool.
Medium and, takes.
You know, lukewarm takes, whatever kind of takes you got, bring them. But Philly is different from New York, but there are some things that are similar.
Yeah.
And folks in the Democratic Party, they're looking for any glimmer of hope. Could this be it? Or are you going to say, no, people? I can't wait to hear what you have to say. 888-477-9499, studio2@whyy.org. And we mentioned that it's Thursday, and you know what that means.
DJ of the day.
Day.
I didn't do the voice. I'm so silly. I didn't do the voice.
Yeah.
DJ of the day. So yeah, you're going to pick the song that we end the show on today. Mm-hmm. It has to be connected to the theme of the show. Here's some ideas. Elections, surprises, New York City, socialism, victory, transportation.
Change, maybe.
Change.
Yeah.
Let us know. Email producer Paige, studio2@whyy.org with your suggestions, and Double P will make the pick.
Yeah, I can't wait. I always get shocked by our DJ of the day pick. Sometimes sometimes I'm like, oh, yeah, I would have picked that. Yeah. But then other times it's songs that I've never heard. So,
yeah, I'm shocked like 50% of the time.
Okay.
All right. Trio of local news stories. Start us out, Cherry.
So we're going to start talking about the coin, the money.
Yeah.
Pennsylvania's state budget talks are in the thick of negotiations. And at the center of it all is the ballooning cost of Medicaid, which has become a major sticking point. Governor Josh Shapiro has asked lawmakers to increase the state Medicaid budget by $2.5 billion, raising the total amount of state spending for health and human services to $21 billion, up from $19 billion last year. By the way, the cost to fund Medicaid, if you include federal dollars, is $55 billion. Cha-ching. It's expensive. That cost is the single largest cost driver in the state. It makes up well over a third of the state budget, and we actually spend more on Medicaid than we do on education. So why is it so expensive? You probably wonder, what in the world? Okay, well, Pennsylvania's population is getting older. They are sicker than they were before the pandemic.
Yep.
And the cost of medications has gone up. Think
Ozempic,
all those things. And so state Republicans, of course, they want to rein the cost of the program in, especially since all the COVID recovery funds have sort of dried up.
Yep.
And they have resumed some eligibility checks. So they're trying to get some folks off the rolls. And you know, federally, the Trump administration is trying to put work requirements and all sorts of things. Everybody wants to rein in the cost of Medicaid.
Yeah. And this this state budget negotiation is reaching the 11th hour. We tend to talk about things like, you know, SEPTA funding, things that are a little more accessible.
Yep.
Will they fund this? Won't they fund that? But a lot of what they're talking about in these 11th hours are these structural growing costs that are increasingly difficult to cover and what to do about it. More tax, less service. I mean, this is like the guts of government right here. So a great story in The Enquirer breaking this all down. And I think it's worth reading just to give you some context. for the conversations we don't tend to have about budgets.
And I wanted people to realize that when you give all this money to one program, you cannot fund a SEPTA. There's other investments that you cannot make.
But a lot of people rely on this. A quarter of Pennsylvanians.
Oh my goodness.
A quarter.
But the conversation is going to have to be had, because if it's going up $2.5 billion this year, what about next year and the year and the year after that?
So, story number two. Hey, Harrisburg, they're not just talking about Medicaid. They're also talking about cursive.
Oh, yeah. You know those leafy letters.
This week, the Pennsylvania House overwhelmingly passed a bill that would require schools, private and public, to teach cursive here in the Keystone State. Senate still has to approve it, but it looks like this will become a law. Yes, in Pennsylvania, you're going to have to teach cursive now, probably. The loopy letters are back, Cherry. Just dive right into this one. The loop, cursive's back.
Yeah.
Thought it was dead. Cursive
you thought
is back.
It was dead. The vote was 195-8. Okay. This is bipartisan.
Been with the 8 on this one. I don't get this.
But people, you know, they want to save cursive. 24 states have legislation to save cursive instruction. I mean, you got to sign checks, right?
Yeah, I can learn how to sign my own name. I don't need to spend, whatever. Go ahead.
You got to be able to read historical documents.
Maybe. They've all been translated now, but yes, go ahead.
And they're just, it's just pretty. Maybe mine isn't, but, you know.
Mine's terrible. When do you ever write in cursive? Just curious.
Rarely these days.
Yeah. I could do my name, obviously, but then when I get to the letters that are outside of my name, like every third one, I'm like, wait a second. Let me think. Like I do, like we had to learn it.
We had to learn it.
And now I don't know it. So that tells me that I don't need it.
Yeah. Well, people, I don't think they want people to be like excellent cursive writers, but they want them to be proficient enough to where like it's not a foreign language to them.
Could I just tell you something? So this bill would amend Pennsylvania's public school code. And in that code, there's actually a long list of things you are required to teach, including... Hmm. This is amazing. So cursive's going to be in there soon.
On the list, yeah.
You have to teach loyalty to the state and national government, safety education, and the humane treatment of birds and animals. I don't know why birds got separated from animals there. But in Pennsylvania, you are...
Because birds are animals, right?
Are they not? I'm confused. So. I would love to go back to when they wrote
yes,
that law.
Yes, they are.
Did you know that you are required in Pennsylvania to teach loyalty to the state and national government?
No.
I'm not sure that actually happens.
I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know if people are really checking up on this. I just thought, whoa, when I read that, I was like, what?
By the way, our producer, Debbie Builder, says... that you have to be able to read grandma's birthday card. So that's
not if grandma hasn't been taught cursive. This phases out, Debbie. This phases out. Okay. Anyways, third one.
Third story. NASCAR is considering a race in Philadelphia.
Vroom, vroom.
Where you ask? Franklin Field in University City. NASCAR president Steve O'Donnell spoke with the Pocono Record. The Poconos Raceway, by the way, is a fan favorite track for NASCAR. And O'Donnell said that Franklin Field is one of the only places that they looked at to put a race within city limits. So Franklin Field, by the way, is the oldest operating college football stadium in the country. It's home to the Penn Quakers. It was built in 1895, renovated in 1922. And the Philadelphia Eagles played there from 1958 to 1970. And then they moved to Veterans Stadium.
Doing the whole Franklin Field history there.
Yeah, I thought I would impress you by writing some historical facts. Resident historian, Avi Wolfman Ahrens.
Okay.
you like that? I wasn't even on my level, Cherry. That wasn't even on my level.
I didn't know all of that. not trying to brag. But yeah, Franklin Field. So this blew my mind when I saw this, that they would do a NASCAR race in Franklin Field. First of all, if you've ever been to a NASCAR track, they're massive.
I have been to a NASCAR track. It's amazing.
They're way bigger than Franklin Field.
So I wondered.
So you'd have to do a lot more turning.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not an engineer. That's something I don't know anything about.
Mm-hmm.
The noise and vibration from those cars in that old brick stadium.
And the exhaust, too.
Feels dangerous to me. I'm sure it's not. Mm-hmm. It just feels like a mismatch.
Well, NASCAR.
Can you imagine those cars like in Franklin? You've been to Franklin
Field. I've been to Franklin Field. It doesn't seem big enough. But, you know.
It would be cool if they pulled it off. I just something about it. I mean, like when I saw it, I was like, wait. Has someone actually like spec'd this and figured out if it's possible?
He mentioned it and went in detail on Pocono No Record. By the way, Philadelphia is drawing in some bigger events. They're going to have their HBCU Classic game at the Link on October 30th when two former Eagles players turned HBCU football coaches will go head to head. So Philly's attracting new events.
Yeah, we got lots of big events. Yeah. NASCAR race in Philly, that would be a new one, though. Yeah. That would be really,
that would be super big.
Here's something that's new. Someone basically calling themselves a socialist and winning a major mayoral primary. That happened in New York City. We want to know what you think about it. 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org. And stay tuned.
And welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We know. It is just one election. But Zohran Mamdani's apparent victory in the New York City Democratic primary for mayor was the kind of stunner that makes you wonder, is this the start of something?
Mamdani ran on bold, some might say reckless ideas. Free buses, frozen rent, city-run grocery stores. And he never ran away from labels such as progressive or even socialist. In fact, he leaned all the way in. Here is the 33-year-old Mamdani after his shocking win.
That new day, the one that we have yearned for, the one that we have struggled for, the one that we have knocked for, have texted for, have called for. The one that we have obsessed over. That new day is finally here, my friends.
So today on the show, we want to dig into this Mamdani mania. Is this a one-off or the start of a new day for Democratic policy and messaging? Well, here to help us discuss, we have State Senator Nikhil Saval from South Philadelphia, an ally and friend of Zohran Mamdani. Senator Saval, so nice to see you again.
Great to be here. Thanks, Avi. Thanks, Cherry.
And in studio, we want to welcome back Daniel Pearson, editorial writer at the Philadelphia Inquirer. And I think a little bit of a Mamdani skeptic, but Dan, I'll let you define that later. Great to have you back here, Dan.
Thanks for having me, Avi and Cherry.
And to our listeners, please join the conversation. We'd love to get your thoughts on our questions of the day, which are, do you think the progressive victory in New York City is a lesson to the Democratic Party? And could Philly elect someone like Zohran Mamdani? You can call 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube, drop those comments. We want to hear those thoughts and those hot takes. Put them in the live chat.
The YouTubers are fired up today, by the way. Lauren says, Zohran is the man. Dems better take note, though they won't. Mamdani is a true leftist. He stands for many things that the Dems are in strong opposition to. Okay, let's bookmark that for a second. Nikhil Saval, I wanted to first ask you about you have a personal relationship with Assemblyman Mamdani. First of all, how do you know him? And I believe you also talked to him as he was mulling whether or not to run in this race, and I would be so fascinated to hear what that conversation was like, as much as you can divulge. So go ahead, I'll turn it over to you.
Absolutely. So Assembly Member Mamdani and I came to know each other actually before he had formally won his assembly election. We both were running for office in 2020, and we were both one of a handful, maybe there were two or three that year, of South Asian socialists running for office in 2020. And so we were put together on sort of Zoom calls, on meetings. We continued to stay in touch by phone. It was the height of the pandemic, so there wasn't a lot of meeting in person. But that relationship blossomed over time. We shared a lot of interests, you know, especially one that came out to the forefront in this election, the cost of living, the issues, the building and creating more affordable housing. You know, things that we care very deeply about. And so we continued to stay in touch. We met over time. And then as he began to mull this publicly, at least this run for mayor, I did reach out and kind of just discuss the idea with him. And it was clear that he was going to run a different kind of campaign. I think that's what he said to me. And I think what one that was borne out, one that really built on social movement power and capacity and people's ability to support a campaign of this kind, and really, really communicating clearly and directly with voters. You know, I think he thought that he could do that to a degree, and with the kind of the backing of lots and lots of people, to a degree that no one else in this mayoral campaign could. And I think he, to hit for him and for all of us, you know, he well exceeded expectations. But you know, I think he was always a very compelling candidate, and I'm thrilled by his victory.
Yeah. I'm just curious, when you were talking to him before the run, or as it was kind of coalescing, honestly, did you think he could win, or was your thought more he will get hopefully in the, like, maybe the top four, top three, mm-hmm. and spark a conversation from there? Honestly.
Well, honestly, so I, of course, I think like a lot of people thought it was, if there was a chance, it was a very distant chance. But I would say that, you know, the with the dynamics of the race, I mean, at the time, of course, Eric Adams was the presumed candidate or incumbent. That changed over the course of the election. But he, you know, I did think that there was a possibility of emerging, a tough, very narrow chance. But one that was theoretically possible. I did think that, and I think he thought so as well.
And real quick, just to follow up, why did you think it was possible with him specifically? He's not the only person mm-hmm. with his ideas, but of course the messenger matters. So why did you think he specifically had a chance in this race?
So I'd say two things, and again, things that were in fact borne out by the race. One is just integrity of his vision, the willingness to run on values, not from them, you know, and just the ability to really extraordinary political talent and willingness to exercise that talent in a number of different forms, to speak clearly and directly about key issues that face, you know, New Yorkers, and not, of course, not just New Yorkers. And then the backing and the orientation towards social movements. Of course, he came out of and was part of the Democratic Socialists of America, New York City DSA. I'm also a member. And it that organization has won a number of difficult elections in New York City. Of course, in part, they were partly responsible for Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, a number of state elected officials, several, two city council people. So it was a large organization that I knew had the capacity to grow and to knock doors. Did I know that it would, that we would, they would have 50,000 volunteers and knock over a million doors? No, but that's, you know, a lot of extraordinary things happen in this campaign. Sure.
Yeah. And before we bring Dan into the conversation, I want to talk about Mamdani a little bit and just educate our listeners, because, you know, he's Ugandan born, naturalized citizen, a millennial. He's also a Muslim, former housing counselor. Could you just give your take on how he was able to make such a broad appeal, sort of breaking all sorts of barriers to bring in so many different people, and specifically younger men?
So I'd say that there were a few key things that happened in this campaign. One is that Mamdani zeroed in and relentlessly focused on a key issue, which was the cost of living in New York City. And it's, again, not unique to New York City, but New York is the most unaffordable, the highest cost of living of any city in the United States. And he demonstrated the importance of this in a key video that he produced early in the campaign, which is he went to the Bronx and Queens, to areas that had swung in no small measure towards Donald Trump, majority Democratic areas. And he spoke to people, and the majority of people he spoke to said that they had either not voted or voted for Donald Trump because of the cost of living. And the fact that the candidates, you know, didn't speak to or provide ways that they might address that issue. And so Mamdani, you know, then subsequently began to unroll a platform and a campaign that was zeroed in on the relentlessly on the struggles facing working class New Yorkers, the struggles, desires, and hopes. And he came up with a number of proposals focused on universal childcare, on accessible public transit, on freezing the rent for rent stabilized tenants. You know, these are things that are hopeful, but they have real tangible, they can be tangibly understood, and they have recent history either in New York City or in other cities across the country. So they can be understood on those terms. Mm-hmm. And so that reached a lot of people. That also meant that these were clear issues that campaign volunteers could speak to. I mean, they went to door to door and could actually very quickly and clearly outline the proposals that the campaign was running on. They could speak to about the issues that that faced them. And, you know, this of course, group of people grew to 50,000 people. One out of every 200 New Yorkers canvassed for Zoran Mamdani. If you were a New Yorker, it's a chance that you got your door knocked on, not just once, twice, maybe three times. You probably knew someone who was canvassing. And then finally, and this is probably the most noted aspect of the campaign, but it's worth underscoring, is his ability to communicate and his willingness to communicate anywhere and everywhere. Of course, he made a number of funny, charming, quite clear and interesting videos but he also spoke to, he didn't turn down a media opportunity. And then I think the high point of this was that I would call it Whitman-esque walk from the northern tip of Manhattan to the southern tip, and just where he met people literally where they're at, in parks, in salons, in, you know, in playgrounds. Just, I mean, it was the kind of retail politics that we think happens more often in campaigns, but actually doesn't. And certainly his principal opponent didn't really do it at all.
Right.
And so he was willing to communicate to really everyone.
Yeah, and I want to read this comment from David, who says, there's a growing divide between the Democratic Party establishment and younger, multiracial, working class voters, many of whom are disillusioned with mainstream centrism. And so, Daniel Pearson, we want to bring you into the conversation. Now that people kind of have this idea of who Zoran Mamdani is from someone who knows him, an ally to him, I want to get your take on this election and just sort of your take. How do you see Zoran Mamdani? Is he a one-off? Did you see him as, you know, New York is different than the rest of Democratic municipalities? Your thoughts?
Yeah, I think, first of all, I think Mamdani himself is clearly a very talented politician. He's charismatic. He's got great hair. His mother is a movie director, which means that he's more comfortable in front of the camera than most people in this country. That kind of background is a huge advantage when you're going to politics, having, you know, been familiar with and comfortable in front of a camera. I also think a big part of this election is his opponent, Andrew Cuomo. You know, Eric Adams was, as Senator Saval said, supposed to be his opponent in this election. He ended up, you know, dropping out of the Democratic primary, and Andrew Cuomo kind of steps in, sucks all the air out of the room. And a lot of voters in New York have very legitimate grievances with Andrew Cuomo. And that's something that goes across the political spectrum. At one point, he said that he didn't want conservatives living in New York State. He obviously has a lot of history with progressives in New York State, having worked with some conservative Democrats to kind of ice them out in the New York legislature for for many years. And then for a lot of people who are more towards the political center, didn't want him either. I, you know, am someone who's more towards the center than Mamdani or Senator Saval, but I probably would have ranked him fifth to avoid Cuomo. Cuomo is just...
And that's the particulars of this race. Cuomo is a singularly repulsive figure to some voters, right? And so you can't ignore that here. That said, just because Cuomo is singularly repulsive doesn't mean... necessarily someone with this little name recognition
could win.
I mean, we're talking about over 400,000 votes. I mean, there's 8 million people who live in New York City. It's a lot of people. So then how do you explain that, and do you draw lessons from it?
I think it's hard to draw lessons from this. Just like it's hard to draw lessons from the victories of Mikey Sherrill and Abigail Spanberger in the gubernatorial primaries in New Jersey and Virginia. Both of those
far more establishment figures.
They're both. I mean, Sherrill is a former helicopter pilot in the Navy. Spanberger used to be in the CIA of all organizations. I think their general vibe couldn't be as far away from Zoran's vibe as it gets. They're suburban moms, you know, who have a minivan and will defend the country. That's what their persona is about. So I think the Democratic Party really, you know, it has to include both the Spanbergers and the Sherrills and the Mamdanis, you know, if it's going to have any chance of beating, you know, Republicans.
I think you're saying you don't think it's that exportable.
I definitely don't, because I mean, New York is just a different place. You know, that, you know, Mamdani, if you look at the results, won with college educated white voters. That was his strongest demographic, especially younger ones. If you go to other states, they simply don't have, you know, Brooklyn You know, there's no Brooklyn, there's no Queens, there's no Long Island City in these places. New York City has always been, you know, almost, you know, half foreign born. Right now it's about 40%. Mm-hmm. I would say that New York is strongest when it's at least 40% foreign born, because that shows that it's attracting people from around the world. You know, nowhere else in the country is quite like that. Even Philadelphia is nowhere near that level.
Yeah.
So I think New Jersey and Virginia probably look more like the Democratic Party elsewhere.
Yeah, and I'm going to read a couple comments. We have Harold who says, the Dems need some exciting new young leadership. We are tired of the same old bones. This is why people don't vote. Judy says the message to the Dem Party is that we are fed up of the status quo. Stop with the same old, it's Republican light. And we want to ask you, join the conversation. Our question is, do you think the progressive victory in New York City is a lesson to the Democratic Party? Could Philly elect someone like Zoran Mamdani? The number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And we have Sherry from West Philly on the line. Sherry, you're on Studio 2. Give us your take.
Oh, sorry. Okay. So one of the things I was thinking of is that, you know, sometimes people get, you know, scared of the term democratic socialist. But I think the center has shifted so far to the right that their policies are similar to, you know, FDR's New Deal, you know. And then the other thing in terms of Philadelphia, right now on our city council, we have a couple people from the Working Families Party who I think have progressive values, are working hard for affordable housing. And so maybe one day we can have a mayor who is that progressive.
Yeah. Jonathan, by the way, wrote in with this very similar comment. Thanks for that call, by the way, Sherry, talking about Kendra Brooks and Nick O'Rourke, who are the Working Families Party's representatives on city council. And I also wanted to, again, echoing that comment, Heidi mentions that Mamdani, for her, is a glimmer of hope. Maybe, just maybe, this will dispel the misinformation about what democratic socialism actually is. Socialism is Sweden. Socialism is Britain's NHS. I wanted to ask you, Nikhil Saval, about that label, socialist, democratic socialist. It's a label you also have not run away from. Do you think the tide is turning on the way people interpret that? Or, again, is it palatable in large, heavily blue cities, but really not making inroads outside of that? Your take.
Well, certainly the fortunes of the term socialism have changed in my lifetime. I probably would agree on that a little bit, Dan. You know, it's less of a it is more widely used as a label. It's one that I identify with, and I'm a member of DSA, but you know, I want to just emphasize what it has meant, you know, in this election, and what I think is sort of deducible from it. You know, socialism, I think actually Mamdani himself said this, is about dignity. It's about dignity for, especially for, you know, for working class people, and you know, it was why I think affordability and the cost of living and being able to live a dignified life in New York City was such a key focus of that campaign. And the thing that the campaign was able to do was actually expand the electorate. One of the premises of socialist politics is that there is a kind of a majority level of support for the policies that Mamdani and, you know, Senator Sanders and, you know, other socialists have proposed, and that, you know, that majority would, in, you know, under certain circumstances, and in, you know, truly reached out to and spoken to and organized, would come out to vote in elections. And that happened in this election. You know, Mamdani won in quite an extraordinary coalition. We're still, of course, parsing it out as the numbers come in. But he won in working class, middle class, and, you know, neighborhoods across the city of New York. He won Manhattan, Bronx, and Queens. He won, seems to have won Latino neighborhoods, Asian neighborhoods. He won a majority of neighborhoods that are largely, you know, that are racially diverse. You know, he in terms of youth, he won young voters, you know, under I'm not sure exactly where the cleavage lies, but certainly under 35 across the board.
Yeah.
And, you know, that in areas where he won, he expanded the electorate. And that's just a key thing, is that he in some areas, he expanded the electorate over 2021 by 40%.
Yeah.
That's That is a novel and unusual thing, and I think there are reasons for that. I think, you know, on the one hand, Dan mentioned this about the liabilities around Cuomo. I mean, it has to have been demoralizing for so many people to see the establishment that opposed and persuaded Governor Cuomo to resign in disgrace after he was credibly accused of harassment by 13 people. That same Democratic establishment support him.
Yep.
I mean, that is an extremely strong indictment of that establishment, I should say. And then on the other hand, to have someone who, as we said, have campaigned relentlessly on affordability, but built a really broad coalition, an alliance that was progressive across the board, received the cross endorsement and supported Brad Lander, the comptroller of New York City, raised money for the city council president, Adrian Adams, you know, just also cross endorsed another candidate, Michael Blake. I mean, this was a really broad group, and he campaigned, you know, with bravery and with integrity and courage. And I think those things are key pieces to a kind pain that we might see in the future.
And I want to read a comment here. We have Jack who says Dems are losing their base across the country, while Zoran and candidates, and they mention you, Nikhil, and Cass Green, also Democratic Socialists, are building the base. They are the future of politics. Also, Sean says the outpouring of rage over proposed SEPTA cuts tells us we need reliable, affordable public transit. Mamdani will bring fast and free buses to New York City, and Philly must be inspired to do it next. Also proud to be a constituent of Senator Saval.
You're getting shout outs
in
the comments.
You got your people here, Nikhil. But I wanted to kind of peel back the layers, because we talked about, you know, Mamdani's, you know, charisma. We've talked about the shoe leather type of campaign and grassroots nature of the work that he did in New York City. But I also want to talk about his ideas, because he focused in on affordability. But the Washington Post critiques Mamdani's signature ideas today. They had the editorial board put out a whole piece. They talked about the city-owned grocery stores, no bus fares, freezing rent on a million regulated apartments, and increasing the minimum wage to $30. And they basically said, this sounds great, but in the end, all of these ideas will end up hurting the very people that socialists tend to support. I want to talk about the feasibility of some of this. And I know you have questions about this as well, Avi. I mean, Nikhil, honestly, is he just blowing smoke up the voters, you know what? Or could he actually get this stuff done?
Well, let's talk about a couple of those proposals. So one is the rent freeze proposal for rent stabilized tenants. That's something that was actually in place under a previous mayor, Bill de Blasio. There were several rent freezes, you know, up until, I believe, 2017. So this is the kind of thing that is actually fully realizable. And it happened in the recent past. The other proposal, you know, is the expansion of universal childcare. This is one of these things that is, you know, one of the only, frankly, expansions of the social safety net that we've seen. Incredibly popular. It was certainly unpopular, I think, on Eric Adams' part to try to roll that back. And it's the kind of thing that makes people's lives immeasurably better to be able to enroll a child at the, you know, for in pre-K for free. That would be, you know, I think we have a limited version of that. And I think it would, you know, expansion of that in Philadelphia would be immensely popular. But the thing I would say is that these are the clear proposals that are part of a vision, but they don't exhaust that vision. You know, the ability to reduce the cost of housing in a place like New York City, or frankly Philadelphia, is partly tied to how much rent costs, and rent is, you know, is hugely important. It's also tied to the supply of housing. It is also tied to the construction of affordable housing. Where can people build affordable housing? I mean, those two things are also tied to supply. We're constrained in Philadelphia and deeply in many parts of Pennsylvania by zoning constraints, by permitting. These are things that we can change. We can change at the state level. There are things we can do at the city level. So I think, you know, a lot of this is going to require liaising in New York with the legislature, as it does in Pennsylvania. I mean, universal childcare required that under de Blasio. So these are things that you know, I think are major components of reducing the cost of living in New York City, and yeah. I think they're serious.
Well, let me so I want to ask you about this, Dan Pearson, because I think something we just haven't discussed here, which I think is so key, is that I here in Philadelphia understood like three or four things that Mamdani was running on, mm-hmm. even though I'm like not a constituent and really not paying that much attention. Freeze the rent, city-run grocery store, free bus, free childcare. They're so simple. These are incredibly direct and simple messages. That has to be part of the reason. I think that has to be part of the reason he won, Dan. And the question I think is, should Democrats replicate that, even if in their hearts they think the solutions to these problems are a little bit more complex than free bus, free childcare? I mean, I want you to help us dig into that.
Yeah, I mean, personally, I wish that he had run on better bus rather mm-hmm. than free bus. You know, Senator Saval and I could probably talk for a whole hour about housing, but we agree too much there. So I'll talk about where I don't agree with him.
Sure.
Okay. And I really, you know, I really would urge a lot of skepticism and caution in particular about the idea of free buses, mm-hmm. And especially in Philadelphia. As Senator Saval knows, getting state support for public transit is very difficult.
Yeah.
Even in New York, it's not that easy. They just passed the congestion tax and implemented that. It's going to bring about $500 million every year. The free bus would cost more than that.
Yeah.
And as a transit rider, I know that I would prefer to have more bus than free bus.
But so, before we go too deep on that, though, yeah. because I get the policy disagreement here. Should the buses be free? Should the rent be frozen? That's a policy disagreement. The thing to me that separated Mamdani's campaign was the messaging component.
The simplicity of it.
Yeah.
Democrats are the they always do the 5-point plan, here's the blue paper, the white paper, whatever color it's supposed to be. There was just none of that here. He did have the plans. You could go find him, but that wasn't the messaging. And I think the question is, even if you believe that better bus is the solution, should you just say free bus?
I don't think it's a good idea to spread bad ideas. And, you know, SEPTA is struggling with fare evasion. MTA is struggling with it as well. If you ask people, which I have, why did you skip your fare? A lot of the time they'll tell you, oh, because it should be free. So putting the idea out that it should be free, I shouldn't have to pay for this. It's not an idea that was widespread, you know, when I was growing up. And that itself has increased fare evasion, in my opinion, as a rider. It's at levels that it wasn't at when yeah. I was growing up.
Yeah.
You know, so because people take this idea, they're like, look, this is my civil disobedience, right? Not paying SEPTA or not paying the MTA, their $250 is my way of sticking it to the man. But you're actually sticking it to the transit agency that yeah. people rely on. And I agree. Democrats should go simpler. Right. They shouldn't be like, here's my 1,000-page. Right. You know, that's something
but not so yeah. simple that you think it sort of elides the truth.
Is yes. What you're I saying. Mean, I don't think you should be telling people things that you're not going to do mm-hmm. and that you can't do. I criticize Governor Shapiro, too. Somebody on the opposite side of mm-hmm. the divide in the Democratic Party for his idea to give fuel rebates, which, again, he didn't actually do that. Right. Mm-hmm. It was a waste, like $1 billion of the state money to give people like. Credits for paying the yeah. gas tax.
Yeah.
I mean, and it also would have gone to wealthier families who have 3 and 4 cars. So, you know, I thought that was a bad idea. I called it out. It was definitely popular, but I don't think, you know, there's being popular and there's being, you know, counterproductive, I guess.
Okay. And let me just read a couple comments because Josh says, my opinion, it's hard to not want the things that are promised in socialism. Who wouldn't want to say yes to a free lunch? Implementing the policies in practice, though, is much different and has the risk of disenfranchising voters if promises don't turn into a result. Said differently, if you promise the world and people believe you, of course you will win, even if your promises are not realistic. I also want to bring in a caller.
And then he said that's what Donald Trump
did. That's what Donald Trump did.
But Donald
by the
Trump
way.
Keeps winning, so yeah. I don't know. What do we take
he's
that?
In power right now, right? A lot of promises. A lot
Build
of campaign
the wall has
promises.
Built a 10-year political career. I don't know.
I want to bring in Jen from Bridgeport, Pennsylvania, is on the line. Jim, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Well, you guys, you've kind of walked it back a little bit, but every time I hear a politician use the word free, it drives me crazy. I mean, what's free? Free health care, free bus rides, free daycare. Somebody's paying for it. And then the people of New York, you know, the wealthy people, their money's going to run out eventually. I don't get when, you know, bureaucrats, you know, say free, free, free. I don't get it.
Mm. Yeah. That's a fair point from Jim.
I'm not a Trump guy. I didn't vote for Trump. I mean, I'm a longtime Democrat, but boy, the Democrats, you guys are way. John Kennedy would not be able to get elected today as a Democrat.
Mm. Yeah.
So that's an important perspective from Jim. Should we bring another back to back?
Yeah, bring another one.
How about we got Jordan from West Philly on the line? I think responding to this question of could Philly, you know, elect someone in the Mamdani mold? Jordan from West Philly, what's your take here?
Yeah, I certainly think we can elect someone like Doron here in Philly because we already have. You have Senator Saval on your program right now, Rick Verjewski, City Council Member Nick O'Rourke, Kendra Brooks, there are others. And it's just a matter of time before we're able to see someone like Doron in the mayor's position here in Philly. But I also want to respond to something that was just mentioned by the previous caller that we can't have free things. I think it's important to look to other countries, countries that are less wealthy than this country, that offer things like paid parental leave, free or very low cost childcare. We can have these things here. We just need the political will to make it happen. And I guess that would bring me to a question I have for Senator Saval. I know that in New York, so much of Doron's success was due to the mass movement that he had behind him. I wonder maybe he could speak to the extent to which we have something like that here in Philly that could make some of these ideas a reality here.
Thank you so much, Jordan. And I want to add something a little to that question for you, Senator Saval. He's asking about sort of where the grassroots are at here in Philadelphia, but maybe also more directly. Let's answer that question. Do you think Philadelphia could elect an openly socialist mayor who's running on a similar platform to Mamdani?
I think Philadelphia has the capacity and to elect figures like Mamdani, people who take a similar stance to, you know, or similar attitude towards politics. It does really depend on the social movement, on the capacity of people to organize. I mean, even many of the policies that have been promised or you know, put forward in campaigns like his, they don't just come into being simply because one muscles a council or a legislature. You actually need mass buy-in. You need mass support. A lot of what we've been able to do in the state legislature that we consider, you know, part of an overall vision has not simply has depended on people being able to build political pressure. Our ability, it's not the only way that we're going to do this, but the ability to fund mass transit has in no small part been, we've seen a massive wave of people putting pressure on elected officials, on the state legislature to fund mass transit. I get 300 emails a day. Mm-hmm. I think that's hugely important. And so, I think that in Philadelphia, we have organizations, we have a very strong and growing chapter of the DSA, organizations like Reclaim Philadelphia, the Working Families Party, 1PA, organizations that fight for criminal justice reform, Amistad, Straight Ahead. I mean, these are, you know, this is only a small part of the kind of overall infrastructure. But, you know, I think that those organizations are in part the basis for what could be a mass movement to elect figures, you know, to various levels of office. I want to be clear.
Yeah.
I don't think we should deduce from the Mamdani campaign that everyone should run for mayor at every place. I mean, that would, you know, that if should that be possible. There were clear calculations made about, you know, the race there, about the campaign, about what was possible, where it was possible to make a message grow. And I think that understanding needs to continue. We still need to campaign and choose races and opportunities, and, you know, to grow the movement and to elect quality candidates. And I think that, you know, those calculations don't, and ideas don't go away when you're trying to decide whether or not to run.
Yeah, and I just wanted to point out that that the New York Times had an analysis showing that Cuomo actually won more precincts with low income and black voters by a significant margin. And so there were some perceived possible weaknesses in the Mamdani campaign. And so we're going to have to leave it there.
Yeah.
And wrap up.
Yeah. Wish we had more time on this because it's such a fascinating conversation.
Very interesting.
But hey, it's an evolving story, right? There's still an election to come in this. So I want to thank you both. Nikhil Saval, mm-hmm. Democrat representing Pennsylvania's 1st District. Thank you so much for joining us and during a very busy time for you. Thank you so much, Senator Saval.
Thank you for having me. Great to be with you, Dan.
And Dan, thank you so much. Daniel Pearson, editorial writer at the Philadelphia Inquirer. I'm sure you're busy too. Thank you, man.
And by the way, you're listening right now to our DJ of the Day pick. It's a song by David Bowie, Changes. Take a listen. Changes. It's gonna have to be a
different man. Time may change me. That was Grant in Philadelphia Philly. Who says, don't want to be a richer man, just gonna have to be a different man. And Liam from South Jersey also nominated that one, said it's an all-time classic, and I would have to agree. Before we get out of here, I do want to thank everyone who makes this show possible.
Definitely.
We've got our producers, Debbie Builder, Paige Marie Bessler, and Andreas Copes. Mike Schiffler is our visual producer. Al Banks and Tina Calique engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCrory. Joan Isabella is WHYY's audio general manager. And from Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia, I am Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Thanks for listening. We'll be back on Monday.